So I wanted to talk about meeting the Dalai Lama from my own experience. And even though we're going to be in this huge auditorium with thousands of other people, you're still meeting him. And that's really what I want to talk about. And this is, you want to close that? This is based on probably over 100 type meetings like this that I've had, full day event kind of things, and half a dozen private meetings with him. So this is sort of my distillate of my experience of how I think about this that I want to share with you. Take it or leave it, whatever. So almost every time I have the opportunity to take some teachings from him, I recognize that this is a blessing, that this is really unusual. Not every time. Almost every time. There have been some conspicuous examples of my not thinking about that, and then it wasn't. So what you bring to the experience is what you will take away from the experience. And some of the teachings are very about ecology, environmentalism. There'll be some intellectual stuff that goes on and so on and so forth, and you can kind of meet it at that level. But as far as I'm concerned, there are other levels of things that are going on that matter more. I used to joke with people that I'd be very happy to hang out with him while he read the phone book. And that's true. I'd be very happy to hang out with him when he read the phone book. I don't care what he's teaching. It doesn't make any difference. There are probably a few bodhisattvas in this world. There's at least one. He is one, as far as I'm concerned. There's no question in my mind about that, which means that being around him is not like being around anybody else, because he's different for all kinds of reasons, and so I won't go into what all those reasons might be. So there's a kind of context, and then I'll tell you some stories about my experience to maybe you can draw something from. So the context is, some of you have heard this before, the context is there is an aphorism or a metaphor or something that I first heard from my Lama Taratilku. And he said that the relationship of mind and wind energy, and I'll articulate more what these things mean, the relationship of mind and wind energy is like that of a horse and a rider. Okay. So thoughts and consciousness ride on energy. And the energy is like the horse, and the thoughts or the consciousness is like the rider. And so the rider directs the horse. The horse carries the rider. So the wind energy carries the thoughts or consciousness. But consciousness can also direct where it goes. Now, this may seem very metaphysical, but we know that our minds and our brains have some kind of relationship, and that there's some kind of energetic thing going on, because they measure with very sophisticated electroencephalograms now. Okay, so thoughts and awareness have an energetic aspect, for sure. Whatever you want to call it, however it works, whatever the relationship is between them, it's there. It's there from the scientific point of view. It's there from the point of view of Buddhism. It's there from the point of view of Taoism. It's there from the point of view of Confucianism. It's there from the point of view of every religion I know. The Buddhists might call it wind energy. Scientists might call it neural energy, or they might call it brain waves, or they might call it libido. In the Hindu tradition, it's prana or shakti. It's chi in the Chinese tradition. Anyhow, these things all flow together, okay? So that's the context. So that's the context for a couple stories that I want to share with you, and then take it for whatever you want. But these are what have influenced my way of being with him. So that's what I'm going to share with you. First time I met him, which was 1982, I was interviewing him for a psychology journal. And even back then, he had lots of people who wanted to come see him. So we're in Dharamsala at his offices next to his residence. And so there's a waiting room where a bunch of people will hang out, and then you get taken in to see him one at a time, or however the situation is. So I'm sitting there waiting, and basically the room is here, and where he is next door, and there's a wall between us. As I'm sitting there, I start getting what I can only describe as a contact high. And it's a good thing that I'd written out my questions, because I was sitting there a while, and then there was a delay, so I was sitting there even longer, and I started getting higher and higher and higher, is the only thing I can describe, until I experienced something that Zatsuji calls the space-like or sky-like mind, which is this sense of huge, clear spaciousness with nothing in particular in it except a kind of luminance, which in that situation was punctuated by the sound of the hawks that circled above, because we're on a ridge that joined the Himalayan mountains at that point. And their cries sort of filled the space. So basically, I got stoned out of my mind by just being within 20 feet of him, but not actually seeing him. So you can imagine what it was like when I finally saw him. It was like, okay. But the point of this story is that he has this energy. He has this aura. Now, he sort of banked it down over the years. So that was a while ago. That was 1982. But it's still there. It's still there if you can tune into it, which is sort of the point. And that's one of the reasons for being in his presence, is that you pay attention to him and you sort of send out your senses kind of thing. You can tune into that energy if you want to. I highly recommend it. even if your brain is going and you're kind of listening to what he has to say. But you have to make an effort to do it, because if you get so drawn into the words and the meaning, you can lose track of the other thing. And so I've had experiences where he's been doing a talk, and I've been really wanting to understand something about the talk, like he did a talk in Sun Valley on Buddhism and business, and I was there on the university's dime, and I brought some business professors, so I was really kind of like, I gotta, think about what he's saying here, even though he was sitting 6 feet away from me. I gotta think about what he's saying here, and bring it back to the university and all this, as if anybody at the university really cared, right? And so it's like I didn't get into that space of having a sense of his presence. So see, it's a matter of there's certain you what you bring to the situation is sort of what you'll take away from this situation, because he was still there. It was just that I was okay. So that's one thing to think about. That's one story. The other thing is, after Tara Tulku died, we went to see His Holiness to talk to him about our own practice. And so the context is our deep love for our teacher who's died and our grief about that. So we were talking to him, and he said it's very important to remember that whether the Lama is alive or not, in the body or not, doesn't matter from the point of view of your practice. And then he said, the Lama and the Yidam are one. So let me explain what that means. Yidam means, it's composed of two words, and it means mentally constructed, mind made, literally is what it means. So when you imagine in your meditation practice, green Tara, say green Tara in front of you, or that you are green Tara, or Manjushri, or any of them, it doesn't make any difference. The technical term for that image is Yidam. So when he says that the Yidam and the Lama are one, what he was saying, and I've thought about this for years, so I think this is what he was saying. How can I say this is what he was saying? I think this is what he was saying. What he was saying was that the essence of what it is about the Lama that has really deeply connected with you, that you really care about, is his own practice with the Yidam, with the image of the Bodhisattva, which is, he's so perfected that internally he is that, right? Internally, Tara Rinpoche was all the Bodhisattva images, all the Yidams, Green Tara, Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, he was all of them. There was no difference between the essence of what was Tara Rinpoche and those Yidams, those Bodhisattvas. That's why he was a great teacher, because he had practiced to perfection. So His Holiness was saying, remember that there's no difference between the two. And so why does this matter? Well, of course, for us at the time, one of the reasons it mattered was because we missed him, but he'd given us this practice to do. So His Holiness was saying, when you do the practice, when you imagine you are Green Tara successfully, that's when you and your teacher become one in that practice. Okay? So what's the point of this story? Well, the Dalai Lama is the greatest master of all of these practices probably around. Or if he's not, he's one of the handful. Okay? So what does that mean? It means if you practice Green Tara, when you see him, remember to look and see Green Tara. Don't just see the outer him, which is easy because he's one of the greatest speakers you're ever going to see. He can work an audience of 10,000 people like nobody else. He's been trained to do it. He is a master of working the audience. And that's great. Enjoy it. But remember who it is that's there. If you practice Green Tara, remember that that's Green Tara sitting there talking. If you practice Shakyamuni, remember that's Shakyamuni sitting there talking. And why is that important? Because when your awareness is in the same space as his, you're sharing that energetic space with him. Remember, we're talking about horse and rider. Now you're sharing that energetic space with him. You can tune into that energy, and that means you're also tuning into the energy of Green Tara. I mean, mostly we imagine Green Tara in our practice. We don't get to actually sit in Green Tara's presence. But you'll get the chance, if you bring your mind to the process, to sit in Green Tara's presence. Now, if you can do that, if you can make that connection and you can feel the joy or beatitude or wonderfulness of it, then what you want to do is you want to remember what that felt like. You want to remember what it felt like to be in that energetic space. And when you drive home, remember it. When you get home, remember it. When you wake up in the next morning and you do your meditation practice and you meditate Green Tara, remember what you felt when you were in his presence, because his presence will bring Green Tara alive in your practice, or Manjushri will come alive in your practice. See, that's the difference, and that's the reason initiation is so important. It's the difference between just having an abstract idea, even very clear abstract idea of Green Tara, and having Tara be alive, because now you get a chance to meet Tara. Because he is. He's Tara. He's everybody. He's all of them, right? They're all there. So again, this may sound a little abstract, but if you remember this idea of mind and energy being two sides of the same something, horse and rider, you can have a sense of how this is true, how this is real. And you can have that deeper level of experience while you're listening to whatever he has to say. You can make that connection with that energy. And if you continue to practice with it, it will never leave you. But you have to practice with it. So before everybody came, I was thinking today, or sitting out on the porch, what do I want to tell people? You know, I don't know what I want to tell people. But I've been feeling his presence really strongly for the last half a dozen days or so, as this sort of is pulling together. I mean, I've had the merit of being able to connect all of you and a lot of other people with him in the future. And so some of the fruit of that merit, right, I'm already experiencing. And sometimes I feel his presence and sometimes not. It's stronger and weaker. Like when you're shortly after you see him, it's really strong. And as time goes on, it kind of fades away, fades away, fades away. But you can practice with it, and sometimes it comes back strong. So I was sitting on the porch, and it was sort of like, well, he's sort of floating around over our house. You know, I could feel him around here. And it's like, well, what do you want me to say? Okay, you know, maybe this is a good thing to say. Okay, so you can bring that into your practice. That's the greatest value of this. I mean, it's great to learn about Buddhism and environmentalism. You could read about that, you know. But this is a little bit different, okay? So there's that. And then sort of the last thing I want to share is about sound. Now, I don't know exactly how the teachings will go. Often, he will do the teachings in English. His English is so-so. It's possible that some of the teachings will be in Tibetan. So probably the Colosseum teachings will be in English. Possibly the teachings at least in the afternoon, at the University of Portland will be in Tibetan. Now, they'll be translated in English, so you'll hear a lot of Tibetan, and then you'll have some English. You hear some Tibetan, then you'll have some English. I've had a friend who said that used to drive her crazy. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to say this Tibetan. And then finally, here's this English, and then it's this incomprehensible stuff, and then she's trying to understand what does that mean. Then there's all this Tibetan. I said, think differently about what this is. Everything a bodhisattva says is mantra. Everything that comes out of his mouth is mantra. Imagine, if you're listening to the Tibetan, that he's like a musical instrument playing this incredible sound. It's Tibetan. You don't know what the Tibetan means. There's actually an advantage to that. He speaks the finest, most refined Tibetan of anybody. And what that means is there's a cadence and there's a lyricism to what he speaks. And when you listen, you can hear his voice develop, and it's almost like hearing waves developing and then crashing on the beach as he comes to a certain kind of a conclusion. You can hear it in the sound of his voice. So if you just tune into the sound of his voice, you're tuning into the energy of him, and you can flow with that energy, and you can experience that energy. And it doesn't matter that you don't know what the Tibetan means. It's completely irrelevant because it's like mantra. You just listen to the sound, and it just, if you can tune into that sound, it can really carry you. So we had a friend, and I have told this story to some people before, who was talking about being bored in this way, so I gave her this advice. And so when we were in Long Beach a year ago, she managed to find seats up front, and so I could see her. And instead of fidgeting, she tried practicing this. And I noticed that she sat down at 9 o'clock in the morning, and she didn't move a muscle until lunchtime. Just didn't move at all. And at lunchtime, I said, well, Sandra, what was that like? She had some, it was good. You know, it was like she like related to it in a different kind of way. Related to it in a very different kind of way. So I don't know how he'll teach, but there are a lot of different dimensions to what are going on, and it's pretty important from my point of view to be sensitized to the non-obvious, the non-ordinary, the subtler, and that those are the things that you really want to carry away. The intellectual stuff, you can get that anytime. Here's the unusual thing, though. If you really get tuned in to the deepest level from which all this is coming from, you get it anyway. It'll come out of your mind in weird ways that you didn't expect when you're dreaming one night, or when you're thinking something, you think, where did that thought come from? Oh, that's where that thought came from. Because it was kind of going, you know, it's happening. It's like when you're driving a car on a road that you know really well. It's kind of like you don't pay that much attention, but you don't have an accident either. There's some part of your mind that's perfectly aware of what's going on, right? Well, of course, you don't want to be unconscious, I don't think, of what's going on in that situation. But, you know, your mind can take care of the intellectual stuff. It's good at that. And really where your effort probably needs to go is kind of another level. So, you know, we'll all be sitting together, and to the extent that my mind doesn't go crazy, you'll notice that I'm not going to even... It's not like I might not seem like I'm there in a certain way, but I'll be very there because this is what I really care about. You know, every time I see him, I think, will I be fortunate enough to see him again? And so far, it just happens. And I hope it'll just keep happening, you know. So those are my thoughts. And we can talk about this too, but as I say, that's just from my personal experience. And so I share that with you as maybe something that would be helpful. Because that's, you know, if it's helpful, it's good.
Yeah, the other part of this is probably letting go of expectations. Because I know that there was one point when the Dalai Lama came to Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, and the dean of Grace Cathedral afterwards said something to David like, well, I don't get what the big deal is, you know. And this is somebody that you would think would be, you know, very attuned to what was happening. But again, so I think some of that has to do with expectations. And sometimes, you know, people, when he first starts talking, if he's doing English, it's kind of slow and kind of a little bit stumbling in the beginning and stuff. But it's actually a really good way to give the audience time to settle, so that they can kind of take in. But it's easy to be, you know, like if you want something else, you know, it might to be impatient, you know, with it. So in that regard, it's just good to just kind of let go of expectations. Don't worry about, you know, if you, you know, that you might be out of harmony with, you know, what's going on in terms of standing up at the right time or whatever. I don't know if they're even going to do any of that. Usually when he comes in the room or into the auditorium, people stand. And if you want to bow, some people run out in the aisle and do, you know, prostrations. I have no idea what the situation there is going to be like for that kind of thing. So you just have to do whatever in your heart, take part in whatever you want to, what's in, you know, feels good to you, what, you know, what your heart tells you to do, and not worry about the rest of it so much.
Yeah, if you want to see what a master of an audience he is, there's a YouTube video where he's teaching on the Great Mall at the nation's capital in D.C. And the original recording he was introduced by Whoopi Goldberg, but that part seems to have disappeared. Whoopi seems to have disappeared for some reason. I don't know why. She did a wonderful introduction, but anyway. So he's standing there, and you can see, there's sometimes they show the audience, and then there's the Capitol in the background. And he's sort of standing there, and you can look at him, and you can see him sort of like, what's going on here? Who are these people? And you can see he's sort of, you know, working the relationship between them in the very beginning. And then there's a certain point where he goes, click, and he's got it. So I mean, he's amazing as far as working an audience is concerned, which is a whole other kind of thing. Except the way he does it, of course, is he understands the energy of the collective, you know. And when he finally gets it and he tunes into it and it tunes into him, then so you might see that.